ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Well, after the success of NASA's Apollo missions in 1969, resulting in successfully landing humans on the surface of the moon, there was a sort of a hiatus in moon exploration. Almost as if, well, we've done that, and no one really has a good idea about what to do next. In fact, the time between moon missions got so long that people began to wonder whether we really did land on the moon in 1969. Space exploration moved to other areas of the solar system, particularly Mars. But suddenly there has been an explosion of interest in going back to the moon. Just this year, as I mentioned, no fewer than five, possibly six missions are planned. Already the Japanese and the private American company Intuitive Machines have gone, albeit landing rather scratchily, either upside down or on their side. But more missions are planned. The European Space Agency is in. The Chinese and Indian space agencies have successfully made soft landings of robots on the moon already and plan more. And, of course, NASA's Artemis project plans to send humans back to the moon the year after next. Why all the activity and why all the haste? Well, it does appear that the discovery of water ice on the moon's poles has dangled the possibility of being able to make rocket fuel on the moon, a crucial step perhaps in getting rockets to Mars. And then there's the possibility of mining the mineral wealth of the moon, which appears to be considerable. There are deposits of lithium, silicon, titanium, and who knows what else. All of which raises the question, yes, but who does the moon belong to? If anybody, if companies and states are setting up bases on the moon and making use of its resources, then who regulates all this activity? Indeed, can it be regulated? A.C. Grayling is a philosopher and founder and principal of the New College of Humanities at Northeastern University in London. He's written many books, and his new work, Who Owns the Moon, discusses the question in detail. He joins us this evening. Professor Grayling, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, Philip. Thank you for your welcome to me tonight. Thank you.
It's terrific. It's great to have you on. Well done. It's the most interesting book. I mean, I suppose the answer to the question of your book, Who Owns the Moon, is nobody. Isn't at the moment, isn't it?
No, and in a way that's part of the problem, but also part of the good news. So it's a very mixed story, this one. Back in 1967, the byblow of the Cold War, The United Nations came up with a thing called the Outer Space Treaty. So just keep that date in mind, 1967.
There is a treaty we signed. It's called the Outer Space Treaty. It does sound like something out of a science fiction novel. It's not, but it's there.
No.
It's there. Who signed it and what does it say, Anthony?
Well, what it says is that there are to be no military installations, no nuclear testing on the moon. I mean, that idea about testing nuclear weapons on the moon seems completely bizarre, but you know, prior to that, the United States had considered testing nuclear weapons in Antarctica, which would have been a horror show. Hmm. But at any rate, the point is that it is a byblow of the Cold War in the sense that the United States and the then USSR were very, very keen to try to marginalize anywhere that could be an unexpected trigger for conflict. You know, they had problems in the Arctic, which is where they abut one another. So they were quite enthusiastic about the Antarctic Treaty that happened earlier. But also, just to make sure that, you know, there would be no problems, they wanted to make provisions for what lies outside the orbital zones of Earth, and in particular the Moon. And this was because, of course, the USSR and the US were racing one another in space at the time. USSR had been the first to put satellites into space in 1957. And then, of course, they first put a man into space, Yuri Gagarin. And the whole thing about, you know, my rocket is bigger than your rocket, yeah, was what prompted the US to get men on the moon before the end of the 60s. Now, that phase of the race, as you pointed out in your introduction there, that kind of faded away after a bit. But actually, all this interest, which we've seen just in the last couple of years, really boiling up about the moon, that's really press at last taking notice of the fact that interest has been boiling up among those who know about these things. So for the last couple of decades, people have been planning to make use of those resources on the moon, the water ice you mentioned, also the possibility of these extremely rare and very valuable minerals, which are needed for our modern technologies, our iPhones and computers and wind turbines and so on. And this is why things have really taken off. And now that 1967 treaty, which was really just the let's just park the issue kind of treaty, mm-hmm. no weapons, but otherwise the moon is anybody's. The moon is what sometimes people call it terra nullius, means no man's land. If you can get there, you can do what you like there, is in effect the message. And that is the problem.
Mm. Yes, you that's right. As this conversation goes on, you'll see why, if you're listening, you think, well, why does it matter? You'll see why it probably does as we move on. But you approach the issue, at least initially, through the lens of international law to try and work out how this might pan out. You conclude by saying the moon is best described as a common pool resource. What's that mean?
Well, that's how it stands at the moment, technically speaking. It's something which is available to anybody, and anybody can make use of it if they can get there and, mine it or put bases on it. And my anxiety about that is that if there's no regulation of what might happen up there, the prospect of competition between people who find that there is, the mineral analog of gold, and that there are things up there which are very, very valuable. And there are two things that are particularly valuable, I'll come to in a moment, that the competition will end up with sharp elbows, and sharp elbows turn into conflict, and conflict rebounds on Earth. It's not going to stay out there on the moon or in space. And so, not having any kind of framework in place at all for thinking about how, when the Chinese and the Indians and the various Artemis nations and so on do begin operations on the moon, there is a potential for trouble. I'll give you an example of how this might work. Supposing you land a base, you set up a base on the moon. It might just be a robot-operated base, might not even have people in it. But you don't want anybody else landing anywhere nearby because, they could sandblast your equipment or knock it over or disturb the electronics or the community. So you're going to want to have a little zone around where you are. And this is something which is, you talk about those international treaties that I mentioned. I mention them because I point out that the precedents for what might happen on the moon are very, very poor. When you look at the Antarctic Treaty, you look at the attempt by the United Nations to protect the deep oceans, you see that there are these creeping efforts to claim sovereignty, to claim ownership. This is happening in the Antarctic. The Chinese, for example, have said they want an area around their bases, of hundreds of square kilometers, to be their, what they describe as special interest zone, which is just another, flanneling way of saying a sovereign area. And this will happen on the moon. And then that means that the moon does start to fragment up into ownerships. And when that happens, of course, every time you build a wall or draw a boundary, that's the trigger for future conflict. And that's the thing that's worrying me about it.
Yeah, well, it's a real thing because as you point out in your book and has been discussed a lot, the most favoured places to go on the moon, there's top draw real estate on the moon, isn't there? And it's not anywhere. You might think, well, there's lots of the moon land wherever you like, but the most interest is in the polar areas because they have found water ice there. So if you were to have any kind of future possibility of settlement or a base or in any industrial operation, you'd need to be near that water source. And there's not an unlimited amount of that real estate there, is there?
Well, you're dead right. The water ice is absolutely crucial for any activity, not just on the moon, but also, as you pointed out earlier, for anything further, any further exploration to Mars and beyond. Because water ice can be separated into hydrogen, oxygen, and therefore is a wonderful source of rocket fuel. And one of the things which is being discussed at the moment is the idea of lunar orbital stations, which would provide opportunities for getting hold of the rocket fuel resources and being able to just sell it, like a petrol station in space in a way. But there are other valuable things there. You've mentioned some of them, especially things like the rare earths, which are so vital to our modern technologies. But something that hasn't been really fully appreciated also is that the surface of the moon, the whole surface of the moon, is covered in rubble and dust. And this rubble and dust is such that if you heat it up, it emits helium-3. And helium-3, when combined with deuterium, enables fusion reactions to take place. Mm-hmm. As you know, back here on Earth, they are now just cracking the engineering problem of how you get more energy out of fusion reactions than you need to put in to get those reactions. And if you can achieve fusion reactions, you can achieve huge, huge, long life supply of completely clean energy. Mm. And this stuff, this helium-3, is valuable. I mean, it's something like, 10,000 dollars for a liter of helium. Now, right. It makes your pint in the pub look a bit affordable, doesn't it? It's really valuable stuff, and it's lying on the surface of the moon. So, you know, harvesting that is something which is exciting people now too. Mm. So, you know, there's a lot of resource up there, and that's part of the reason for the interest in it. Imagine. And the Chinese in particular, now you mentioned the Artemis arrangement, which is kind of organized by NASA. NASA, now that the world has moved rightwards in political terms and taxation has become an even more toxic idea, in the case of the US, they don't want to be spending public money, which is why NASA now commissions private enterprise, and you mentioned one of the companies involved, to do all this work. But that group of countries sponsoring their private enterprises to do this stuff on the moon is balanced off in a way, in a rather uncomfortably, kind of reminiscent way. The fact that China and Russia has just started to think about going back into space too. It's had a couple of failed attempts recently, but they've been absent from space for some time. But China and Russia, with China as the senior partner, have themselves established an axis for exploitation of the moon and for activity in space. And this reprises a sort of Cold War standoff, a Western and an Eastern group. And so you can see that that too also makes you think, well, there's altogether too much chance of trouble.
Exactly. We're talking with Professor A.C. Grayling from the New College of Humanities at Northeast University in London, who's written a most intriguing book called Who Owns the Moon, which does raise all these issues of, with the current frenzy of activity in outer space, what law applies out here? Just in general, Anthony, what law does apply in space anyway? I mean, if someone gets into an argument on the International Space Station and injures somebody, or even killed somebody, heaven forbid, what law applies anyway?
Okay, so there are sort of three different aspects to this. One is, if you look at the 1967 Outer Space Treaty itself, plus an attempt that the UN made later in 1979 to firm up that agreement a little bit, that failed because, of course, countries by then were thinking, well, no, we don't want to be restrained when we get out there in space. We want, you know, free rein for our activities. And so what happened in 79 was there was merely an agreement, and the agreement was we'd all be good chaps when we're out there. Mm-hmm. And that sort of good chap idea is predicated on the idea that the laws that apply on Earth, international customary law, for one thing, and the laws of participant nations themselves, would still apply. So if person A, you know, murdered person B on the moon, they would be liable under law back on Earth for having done it. So to that extent, Earth law.
But under the law of under whose law?
Well, as I say, firstly, there are international laws, customary laws, but also there are national laws, and national laws could be paid in aid if something like that happened. The thought there is that anywhere humans go, even if they go to the limit of the galaxy, they're still subject to the laws of their home nations and of Earth. That idea. But when it comes to things like the way that international agreements govern trading relations and mining activities and protection of the environment and all those sorts of considerations, That doesn't apply out there. There aren't regulations for that out there. Instead, what we have is just for the orbital zone close to Earth, where there's now, you know, a terrific traffic jam of satellites and constellations of satellites up there doing all sorts of things like communication, GPS and military surveillance. I mean, all that going on. Lots of regulation agreements are attempted, sometimes between states, sometimes internationally, are applying to everybody who's being involved up there. But even in that area, it's a bit of a mess. And
did Elon Musk have to ask anybody for permission to launch all those thousands of satellites which he's launched for the Starlink internet service?
Yes, there would have been requirements. I mean, for example, there is an arm of the United States government to which reports have to be made about launches and returns.
Mm.
And, you know, there are anxieties about damage to, you know, people and installations on Earth when bits of things fall out of space back to Earth. And also there are anxieties about, whether if you go to the moon or you go somewhere else in space and you return something to Earth, whether you can ensure that it's not going to bring anything polluting or dangerous back. So these are called payload reviews. And anybody who's firing rockets into space has got to be subject to those. But none of that really applies to the moon. So the moon, as a no man's land, as something which is regarded as open season, really, even in terms of the 1967 treaty, that introduces a whole different question. And the different question is, how are relations going to be regulated when there are different agencies, different states, different private enterprise up there on the moon doing stuff and perhaps getting in one another's way? What would be the effect if they do get in one another's way and they get cross about it? That's the problem which is unregulated.
Exactly. I'm talking with Professor A.C. Grayling, philosopher and founder and principal of the New College of Humanities at Northeastern University in London, but about his new book, Who Owns the Moon? One of the things you do in your book is to say, well, look, what have we done in the past here on Earth to try and deal with this? Because there are, in a sense, common pool resources here on Earth. I mean, the ocean is one, the atmosphere is another, and then there is the question of Antarctica, which, gee, this is a very unusual case, isn't it? Tell us about how the Antarctic Treaty came about and why there hasn't been a bigger fight about Antarctica.
Yes, so I think it's always very important to have a look at the precedents of things, and in particular to look at the most recent ones. And there are two in particular, Antarctica, as you mentioned, also the deep oceans, and the efforts that have been made to protect Antarctica and the deep oceans would be our best example of how we might try to do something about outer space and the moon. So in the case of Antarctica, what happened was this. There were a number of nations, the British, the Norwegians, the French, who had laid claim to parts of the Antarctic territory.
How long ago? Probably it wasn't really, I mean, it's all quite recent, isn't it? We have the heroic age of Antarctic exploration at the end of the 19th and in the beginning of the early 20th century. And this is where it really swims into people's consciousness, because until then, of course, it's really just, it's an unknown place, isn't it?
Well, yes, but even by the 19th century, the British in particular, because of the power of the Royal Navy, it needed to have lots of islands around the world, so St. Helena and the Falklands and what have you. And the further south it went and round the tip of South America, the more it regarded the Southern Ocean and Antarctica as what it called its sphere of influence. But in the 20th century, when things began to sort of heat up a little bit on the question of actual sovereignty over parts of Antarctica, what the British did was they laid claim to the British Antarctic Territory in the west and north of the continent, and then gave a huge swathe of Antarctica to Australia and to New Zealand. In those days, of course, Australia and New Zealand were still regarded as kind of English counties, so they were part of the British Raj in Antarctica. But during the war, Second World War, while Chile and Argentina, who had themselves been having any number of scraps over sovereignty claims of the islands or off the south of South America. They thought that the UK would be distracted by Mr. Hitler, and so they asserted sovereignty claims over bits of the Antarctic. And that prompted the British to go back to the Antarctic and set up a base and then try to go to international law to get a settlement of the sovereignty claims. And the whole thing was a mess. So by 1961, the US decided to box the ears of its allies in the NATO alliance, since all the sovereignty claimants in the Antarctic were part of the Western alliance, and say to them, look, you guys have got to get together and you've got to have a treaty and you've got to decide what to do. So they came up with the Antarctic Treaty in 1961. And that treaty has the most brilliant fudge in it. It provides a way for parking all these sovereignty claims so that there won't be conflict and trouble down there. And it states that the Antarctic is to be preserved purely for scientific research, cooperative activity, never to be exploited commercially and all that, and to protect it. Now, again, this was a very happy byblow of the Cold War because, as I mentioned earlier, the US and the USSR were very keen to park anything, any part of the world, where a potential for conflict could arise. So they were in the shadows behind this, and this agreement was established. Hmm. And ever since then, it has been as the most admirable and successful of all international treaties. But, alas, I point out in the book that it's fraying at the edges.
Well, yes, for reasons which you've just really alluded to, in the essence that the Antarctic Treaty has been wonderful, but partly because it's kicked the can down the road, hasn't it?
It has indeed, yes. Now, from the point of view of the sovereignty claims, and is still way down the road, but there's something looming which is problematic. I mentioned a little while ago about the Chinese saying that they wanted to have special interest zones in the Antarctic.
Hmm.
And this is almost certainly because in the year 2048, not too far off now, the moratorium on mining in the Antarctic comes to an end.
On mining?
Mining. Hmm. And you can bet your bottom dollar that at very least the Chinese and maybe some others might want to start digging holes into the Antarctic. So, there is a looming problem. And every effort that has been made by the Antarctic Treaty system to bring the Southern Ocean, the oceans around the Antarctic, into the protective terms of the treaty has been denied by the major fishing nations of the world. And the Southern Ocean is now in a very bad state because of overfishing. So here you get an example of the very best international agreement that we seem ever to have been able to reach is looking, very pockmarked at the moment. And that makes you think, well, if we were to get some kind of similar arrangement on the moon, how long would that last before it started to fray?
Mm. Yeah, this is very critical for the Antarctic, isn't it? Because it's such a fragile and beautiful place, extraordinary, as anyone who's been there, I have recently and seen it up close, albeit just the tip of the Antarctic Peninsula, but it is an extraordinary place. And if it was to be mined, then you can fully appreciate the disaster, ecological disaster, that would be to its unique place. Although given the history of humans, Anthony, I don't know whether you're an optimist about this. It's hard to be optimistic, isn't it?
It is hard to be optimistic for two reasons. The first is that people only abide by treaties so long as it's in their interest to do so.
That's right.
You only have to mention the three words Molotov and Van Ribbentrop to know that a treaty, can be very, very easily and savagely broken as soon as it ceases to be of interest or use to the parties to it.
Mm.
And the second thing, of course, is that the profit motive has practically destroyed our world and destroyed societies and what have you. It is the most vicious thing.
I'd like to interrupt for a moment because I want to bring some other listeners in here.
This is Nightlife with Phil Clark
on ABC Radio.
and to others joining us. This is Nightlife. We're talking to Professor Anthony Grayling from London about his fascinating new book, Who Owns the Moon? And we were talking about the example of Antarctica and the Antarctic Treaty, which has been quite successful, although in holding off development of Antarctica, although, as Professor Grayling's just advised, all this is coming to a head in, what is it, Anthony, 2048, is it, 45?
Correct, yeah. 2048.
That's right. You were saying there are two powerful reasons why, of course, all these treaties might be broken by humans. One is that treaties are only ever adhered to if it's in the nation's interest. And secondly, of course, there is the profit motive.
Yeah, exactly. And the profit motive, of course, is going to be very, very significant on the moon. I mean, I mentioned the fact that the dust on the moon, you know, somebody pointed out that dust on the moon is more valuable than diamonds. Mm. They say that by the middle of the century, if things really unfold as they seem to be unfolding at the moment, that the total revenues, the total returns on investment in the moon could be as much as $10 trillion by the mid-century. Yeah. And look, there's a really important point here, which is this. In the last 20, 25 years, hundreds of billions of dollars have been invested in the activity that we're seeing now in getting to the moon and exploring its resources and so on. And people don't spend that kind of money, especially not private enterprise, unless they expect a return. So they're pretty confident of getting it. And they're pretty sure that it's just simply a matter of overcoming some of the engineering challenges that they're going to be able to do it. So there's huge money to be made out of it. I mean, I mentioned to you earlier, I said $1,000 a litre. In fact, it's $2,000 a litre of helium-3. So you can see that even just scooping up dust on the moon is going to bring money to people. Mm. And it's going to make people want to rush there. Now, you pointed out, Philip, a very good point, which is that, of course, whereas the regolith, that's the dust and rubble on the moon, is everywhere. Other things, of course, tend to be in geological seams. And the water ice tends to be at the south pole of the moon and in very ridges. And so there will be areas of focus, of intense activity and rivalry to get hold of these resources. So it's unlike the Antarctica, of course, there isn't an environment to be protected. As far as we know, there aren't any little green men or microbes or anything on the moon.
Don't go too far. Don't go too quickly on this, Anthony.
Okay. Well, yes, quite. Well, one never knows.
But so look, environmental. Can I raise a technical issue? Because I'm sure some listening might think, well, look, all this is all very well, and helium-3 may well exist in abundance on the moon. Well, it does. We know that, actually. And these other minerals may well exist on the moon. But they exist on the moon, and transporting things back from the moon in any quantity whatsoever, I mean, maybe a litre or even a few litres or even 50 litres is one thing, but transporting anything in any amount, particularly mineral resources or indeed any elemental resources, is to all intents and purposes beyond us at the moment, isn't it?
Do you know, I so often hear this argument. It's so far away, it's so difficult, we can't do it at the moment. So this is the problem down the road. Well, you know, when you look at the rapidity with which technological advance has happened over the last few decades, it's been absolutely dizzying. Mm. And every technological advance potentiates yet further advances. So, you know, that consideration that's got to be set aside, because within the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, it's going to look like old hat to be bringing back tons of materials from the moon. And as I said, you know, this is an engineering challenge, and they're working at it. They're throwing billions of dollars at it. It's going to happen. It's not a problem, an invisible problem, meaning it just simply cannot ever be done. And now that there is fuel up there, you know, the water ice providing rocket fuel, it means that one major question has been resolved already on that score. Hmm. So, you know, I sometimes say to people, look, the world today is in such a terrible mess. Shouldn't we be concentrating on the world as it is now? And then my reply is to say, look, if we had thought years ago about what might happen and we put some things in place before it did happen, then we would be pleased with ourselves. Hmm. And that's, you know, I'm just thinking 20 years' time on the moon. Shouldn't we be thinking now about how we construct a framework that will make this, you know, potential area of conflict a bit more manageable.
That is a philosophically interesting question, isn't it? Because there would be those listening to this conversation who would say, this is the problem with humans. We've stuffed up this beautiful blue planet of ours, and we have no framework to leave it and not stuff up anything else we touch. And we ought to be resolving problems on Earth of homelessness and lack of clean water and lack of food and lack of equity and so on before we do this. What do you say to that?
Well, again, you see, this is a problem for the Earth. You know, we're talking about the moon. We're talking about the potential for conflict between rivals on the moon. But those rivalries, those conflicts will rebound on Earth. So this is not, a moon or space problem. It's an Earth problem. Mm. We've got to be putting something into place to be sure that we're not going to just increase the difficulties we have back here on our home planet because of the kinds of things that happen out there in space. And you know, what one says this in full consciousness of the fact that there are actually many very good things that might happen with developments out there in space. Do you remember the Teflon on your frying pan? I mean, that came from you know, developments in space technology a long time ago. And one can imagine there will be a huge number of spin-offs that will come from all these new developments. Also, the not just the technology, but also human imagination, possibility, new perspectives, new horizons. If there are quite a few people up on the moon looking back at our beautiful blue planet, it might change their view about how they behave and how Earth should be behaving. You know, that little beautiful little picture that was taken by the Apollo astronauts, it had that effect on people for a little while. But, you know, it really is a question of perspective. So there are good things, but you have to prepare for the bad things. And that's the point that we need to get across.
Mm. You raise a couple of other pertinent examples. You say the law of the sea, and the example in the late 19th century of Africa are quite salutary examples. Let's talk about the law of the sea for a moment, because this is regarded as a common pool resource, isn't it? Well, essentially, that is the high seas. But this has not stopped, of course, the competition for resources, particularly fishing, as we know. And then there is the great big elephant in the room. That's an inapt metaphor, I know, because we are talking about the deep seabed, and there's an enormous amount of stuff, wealth, resources on the seabed, which is within reach, lots of it, of resource extraction companies, isn't it? And we don't really have an international agreement that's any good that governs it, do we?
No, we don't. This is a particularly striking example, this one, because the United Nations has been trying for decades and decades. I mean, it really started back in the late 50s of the last century. And it's only just this year that last year, I think it was, that the High Seas Treaty, which is a little aspect of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, was finally agreed, providing about 30% protection of some of the open oceans. This is an attempt to try to stop the drastic overfishing which has been going on. Hmm. But as you say, on the deep seabed, there are very, very valuable minerals. And the United Nations effort has been to try to protect the environment of the deep seabed, not by banning it, mining, by regulating it, by controlling it. Because you see, if you think about it, I mean, mine on the deep seabed of the oceans, you not only destroy the ecology of the seabed itself, you pollute the water column above that area. You generate noise that goes for thousands of kilometers and distracts, you know, all the whales will end up in Sydney Harbour. I mean, you know, there are a lot of problems that will arise from industrial activity on the seabed. And so the magnificent efforts that the UN makes to try to get people to carefully and rationally about these things have failed. And they failed because some big countries, like the United States of America, for example, won't sign up for it. And they won't sign up for it because they want their own homegrown companies to be able to make profits. So if you extrapolate this from the seabed to the moon, you think, well, you know, people are going to be very reluctant to accept restraints and restrictions tests and, you know, temporizings and so on, because they just want to get their hands on, be first, you know, have the first mover advantage and so on, get their hands on that moon without being hampered by having to sign something back on Earth.
Mm.
This really is the worry.
Yes, this major agreement, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, I mean, the United States has not signed this, have they? And they're supposed to be one of the world's law-abiding, rules-based order promoting democracies. But they haven't signed it, have they?
No, they haven't, and that is a real worry. Of course, when one gets down into the weeds of this, what one finds that there are certain aspects of it that they will observe, and that some of their companies, in fact, have pulled back on investment in deep sea bed mining because they're worried about legal challenges from other countries if they do it. So the whole situation is a bit of a mess. But the big picture about it is that here is an incredibly important agreement, the Law of the Sea Agreement, governing what happens on the deep sea beds of the open oceans. And this is something which is, you know, the nations of the world have not been able to establish in a rational way.
Mm.
And I say is a very bad precedent for the moon.
You kind of get the sense that although the technology does not exist at the moment to bring back minerals or resources in any large quantities, that, as you say, is a technological issue which engineering may well provide an answer for. As it, if it gets close to it, we might learn from the late 19th century scramble for Africa, which you set out in your book as well, which is a shameful period in colonial oppression from European powers, Britain included, when they suddenly realised, oh, hang on, that whole part of the continent of Africa, which we knew nothing about, we're starting to learn, we better go and grab it as quickly as possible. It was an appalling scramble, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a prime example of the gold rush phenomenon, you know, thinking that there are resources there are possibilities there, and wanting to be first, wanting to elbow everybody else out of the way. And so you get a scramble. And of course, in a scramble, people are not thinking about, you know, anything other than the profits to be made.
Mm.
And so if you look at that example, look at the example of Africa, you just see this is going to replay on the moon.
Yes, exactly, because if engineering solves certain things, that's right, that countries will think, well, hang on, there's an extraordinary opportunity here and we need to be part of it. At the moment, there are probably, how many countries do you think would be in a position to scramble for the moon? Anthony, I mean, the US, of course, Russia and China, definitely, India, definitely, Japan, possibly, some European space agency collectives. But one of the interesting things is the emergence of private companies. Elon Musk's SpaceX, Intuitive Machines, which launched a robot recently. It's not out of reach, is it, even for private individuals these days?
No, on the contrary. So, you know, China is one of the really big factors in this. And they are pumping an enormous amount of their intellectual and financial energy into doing this. They really, really want to establish a major presence on the moon and to be a big player there. And they're racing along, no question about it. India are doing very well. India successfully getting to the moon much more cheaply than anybody else is. So they've cracked something. But the US and Europe, the Artemis companies, these are private companies. Now, the real worry there is this. If there isn't a framework for how things are done on the moon and in space, then how they will be done in future is being determined not by international agreements, not by countries thinking about, you know, organizing everything in a rational kind of way, but they will be done by the choices of private companies and some very, very rich maverick individuals, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, whoever it might be. How people behave and relate to one another out there in space will in part be the result of their company contracts, you know, their employment contracts. And in the case of China, how they behave out there and what they do and how they expect other people to behave would be the Chinese way of thinking about, you know, how everything is governed from the Forbidden City in Beijing. So, you know, you could see if there is a terra nullius, a completely open zone where you make things up as you go along the way you like to do them, and you're a private company or you're a China, then the future of space out there, until efforts are made by humankind collectively to pull back on the reins and to try to impose some kind of order, well, look at the Convention on the Law of the Sea. Look at the Antarctic Treaty. They don't work. I mean, certainly the Antarctic Treity is being looking a bit tattered, and the Law of the Sea thing doesn't work as it should. So how's it going to work out there in space? Mm. And does this mean that the future of space and the future of humanity in space be not by us human beings, but by just a very, very few of us who happen at this moment to be in a position to make those decisions?
Hmm.
And Philip, let me add one thing to this. I know I'm banging on.
Not banging on at all, Anthony, but go on, yes. Yeah.
Way back in the 1930s, there was a very imaginative character, a man called Wendell, who was thinking about the legal aspects of the air above our heads. So this was the time when aeroplanes started to fly across national boundaries, right? So he was thinking about the legal aspects of that. You know, who controls the upper airspace, the mm-hmm. place where airplanes fly? And then he thought, well, wouldn't you also have a law of space itself beyond the atmosphere? And then he said, it's inevitable. You know, given the rocketry available in the 1930s, it was possible to imagine that at some point in the future, there would be, you know, very successful rockets going out into space. He thought, well, if there is a human of, let us say, the moon and Mars and so on, and history repeats itself as it inevitably will, then human settlements out there will one day want to become independent.
Yes.
So there will be independent communities out there in space. There will be new worlds, you know, not governed by or arranged by us here on this planet, other than by the people who made those settlements, other than by the guys who went out, you know, prospecting for gold in the West, in 19th century America, let us say, there, the law of the gun, the law of whatever, will be the one that provides the basis for what happens out there. Now, that's admittedly a little bit fanciful and so on, impossible. So again, if you reel back to where we are at the moment and we think to ourselves, how would we like things to develop? Would we like things to develop in a way which is us rather than the worst of us? That the kind of structures that we have available to put up there in space will ensure that we don't get problems back here on Earth, then, well, as I say, we should be sitting down and thinking about it really carefully now, and we're not.
Bill from Ugarra says, considering the USA were the first to put a man on the moon, wouldn't they be able to claim ownership of the whole moon? This flag-planting idea is all very well, isn't it, Anthony? It's a thing that that colonialists have tried everywhere. The Brits planted a flag on the east coast of Australia, unbeknownst to the Aboriginal people who lived here for tens of thousands of years and claimed it. It's been imitated in modern times, actually. I'm pretty sure of this. The Russians sent a submarine to the North Pole and planted a flag, a Russian flag, on the seabed at the North Pole, for reasons which I'm sure were symbolic. But there have been plenty of flags planted at the South Pole, haven't there? And the US has got a large base at the South Pole. Mind you, that's open to most people. But this flag-planting thing seems decidedly old-fashioned in this modern era, doesn't it, Anthony?
It does, and it should, but it hasn't quite died away.
Hmm.
You know, that there are new forms and new terminologies for flag planting, and I gave an example of one, the idea of a special zone of interest,
mm-hmm.
which is what China claims over its, or around its research bases in the Antarctic. You can find all sorts of different words and different ways of dressing it up. But yeah, there will be flag planting on the moon. And before the end of this century, no doubt, there will be flag planting on Mars also. Mm. Unless the the principle embodied in the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which says that the moon belongs to no one, can be held up. Now, it's very unlikely to be held up. That's the problem. You know, already private companies wanting to exploit resources, lunar resources, have been looking into the legalities of ownership of payloads that are brought back to Earth. You know, because the minute that you extract something on the moon, you want to be able to lay full ownership to it in order to get your return on the huge amounts of money you've been on getting it. So all these things are going to bubble up, and they get to, and when they start really start bubbling up, they're going to bubble up fast. You know, these developments are going to cascade, and as the engineering problems are overcome, and as you know, even more valuable resources are found out there, when that gold rush really starts, there's going to be no time, no headspace to be thinking about how to organize it properly, and we're going to be playing catch up all the time. Now, we know from history that, that's not a good place to be in.
It is certainly not a good place to be in. Well, look, I'd congratulations on your book. It is a fascinating look at the issue, even if there are no easily promoted solutions here. And the international frameworks that we've tried with the Law of the Sea and Antarctica and even the Outer Space Treaty are way less than perfect, but you have raised a lot of interesting questions and posed the right questions. Anthony Grayling, terrific to have your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Philip. All the best.
All the best to you. Anthony Grayling's book, Who Owns the Moon, is out at the moment. Professor Grayling's principal of the New College of Humanities at Northeast University in London.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.